everyone. This is Salman Askeri. Welcome to Talk Iran, a podcast dedicated to discussing Iran-related issues. In this episode, I speak with Vahid Yuchisoy. Vahid is a PhD candidate in political science at the University of Montreal. He specializes in Iranian and Turkish politics and is very active on social media. When it comes to Iran, he is critical of the pro-reform agenda, even though he admits that he was once on the pro-reform side himself. Vahid and I talk about his background, how he became disillusioned with the Iranian reform movement, the intentions and the role of the U.S. in regards to Iran, Reza Pahlavi, the validity and the results of various polls conducted in Iran, the divisions amongst Iranians on social media, and other topics. All right, let's get on with the episode. I now give you my conversation with Vahid Yuchisoy. I'm here with Vahid Yuchisoy. Vahid, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
All right, let's start by talking a little bit about your background. I noticed that you speak five languages. You live in Montreal, Canada. Your last name is Turkish. Can you take us through your background and talk a little bit about where you come from? You're obviously Iranian as well. And what it is that you do nowadays.
Right. Well, I do have a very complicated background as well, and there are times when people would be quite hard-pressed, I guess, to pinpoint my origins. I mean, my both parents are from Iran, but they left Iran when I was 1 year old, and they settled down in Turkey, which is where I grew up until the age of 20. And there, in order to obtain Turkish citizenship, you know, at the time, Turkey used to be very nationalistic. So they would actually Turkify names as they've been doing it in the southeastern part of Turkey. So they said, well, if you want to become citizens, then you have to pick a Turkish surname and bid farewell to your Persian one. So we had to choose this one without even, and we didn't even know what he meant in the past. So that's how I ended up with a Turkish surname, which I still have maintained in spite of the fact that I've been living in Canada for this, I guess, for the past 16 years. And my parents are, I mean, one of them is Kurdish and the other one is Persian. So it's, well, I speak Turkish as well. And having lived in Montreal, which is a French-speaking, actually, city, and Canada in general, so I speak English and French as well. Well, I think this has all added to the complexity of my background. And, you know, I think there are times when it has been a disadvantage, whereas at other times, it's actually proven to be quite advantageous.
I see. Yeah, you do speak perfect English.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, so I want to dive right into some of the issues. You're pretty active on social media. You've been highly critical of people whom you call so-called pro-reformists. These are individuals who want to see change in Iran, but don't necessarily agree that there should be a toppling of the regime. What do you see as sort of the major problems with their viewpoints?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I've also actually supported the reforms in the past. I've been a very ardent supporter of them. I think that was the case for millions of Iranians who have now become very disillusioned with the reform process. I mean, what I don't actually agree with when it comes to reforms is the fact that, the process has been actually tiresomely long, and there have been authoritarian backsliding at times. You know, it's been a process that has been marked by certain steps, you know, upwards and certain steps backwards. And there has always been this agreement of not this argument of not waking up this sleeping giant, or let's not go too far in case we'll provoke the ultimate decision makers in the higher echelons of power. So we should actually tread very carefully. And this argument of treading very carefully and very slowly, or I guess in a very gradual manner, has been quite problematic for me. I used to believe in it. I used to believe in the fact that Iran, or I guess the Islamic Republic, had the potential of slowly evolving into, I guess, a democratic state, as in the case of the Soviets, or as in the case of South Africa. But this hasn't happened. And, you know, I guess 40 years after the establishment of the Islamic Republic, Iran is still actually riven with quite egregious human rights violations that you know, that are continuing to this day. We are still ranked as the highest country that actual per capita in terms of or in terms of executions per year.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of actual civil liberties, we don't rank very highly according to Freedom House. So, I mean, actually, there's actually a plethora of factors that have really made me quite disillusioned with reform. And, you know, yeah. 40 years have elapsed. You know, as far as the reform process is concerned, it's been 20 years and we still have not made, I mean, I think it really depends on who you talk to, but I find the, well, the progress that has been made to be completely insufficient. Whereas if you were to talk to the ardent supporters of reform, they would evoke the argument of Iran becoming a Syria. So we should actually stick to this modicum of stability that we are enjoying in the Middle East and tread very carefully. And, you know, this is all... I'd say this is also another argument that I've got, well, quite a lot of disagreements with, because...
I think we can all agree on the fact that Iran has major problems with human rights and with a lot of the issues that you mentioned. Aren't you worried about upheaval in the sense
right.
that if we were to foment unrest in the country and really right. motivate to people to get out there and ask for a change... that the upheaval that results from that could lead to violence, could lead to bad actors,
right.
you know, taking
right.
advantage of a destabilized country. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I mean, it doesn't have to be an upheaval. You know, it could be a civil disobedience in a way to force the regime to behave in a certain way. And one of the prime examples of that is the campaign launched by Messi Alinejad, for instance. That's actually a very good example, the White Wednesdays.
Mm-hmm.
The you know, that civil disobedience has put the compulsory hijab on international spotlight.
Yeah.
And, you know, well, I'd say in spite of all the critiques that she has received, well, I still see that she has made quite a lot of progress, much more so than, you know, all this gradual change that we've been talking about. You know, I guess we've been witnessing this phenomena of actually women who've been walking unveiled in various corners of Iran, and this is not really restricted to Tehran. And, you know, also when it comes to the argument of upheaval, well, I guess it also depends, because there are times when such upheaval may also lead to a better future, because we are at this moment confronted with the choice of either dying slowly, because Iran is in the throes of acute environmental problems, while the economy is being quite badly managed. You know, while people are actually are leaving the country in droves, or we might actually push for a change, as in the case of Tunisia. And I also want to make the parallels with Tunisia. Well, I guess in the case of Tunisia as well, there were a lot of people that died. But since that was a country that has a very educated population, I find that country to be actually more comparable to Tunisia rather than Syria, you know, which actually is... you know, a country that has very different socioeconomic parameters that may not necessarily be compared with Iran.
Yeah, yeah, I see. So how do you see the role of the U.S. in all of this? People are rightfully very suspicious of what the U.S. actually wants for Iran. Obviously, the State Department is going to say that they care about the Iranian people. But we all know that they care also a lot about the interests of Israel and Saudi Arabia, for example. That they want Iran's presence in the region to be sort of reduced and diminished.
Right.
But they're acting like the good guys, obviously, and that they say that they care about democracy and human rights when they don't care about
right.
those things in other countries. So what are your general thoughts about the U.S. And its role for Iran?
That's a very good question. I personally am very hoary. I'm very suspicious of the U.S., actually intentions to bring about democracy in Iran. I mean, I totally agree I think the Americans are not necessarily doing it with the best of the intentions. And, you know, if ever they strike a deal with the Islamic Republic, then they might actually, they might resort to completely actually recognizing the Islamic Republic. I think in this context, the role and the capacity of the United States are being Well, are being exaggerated. I'll give you an example. When the Iran protests occurred in 2018, in January 2018, well, it was not a protest that had been actually stoked by the Americans. It was a protest because of the regime's own wrongdoings, its own faults, its own flaws inside the country. So I think if the United States ever wants to help the Iranians, you know, it should do it actually, with the Europeans, actually by helping the activists. And in this respect, I'm quite disappointed with the Europeans as well for their lack of condemnation, you know, when it comes to the human rights violations that have been taking place. So, I mean, actually, to cut a long story short, I really don't think that the United States has the best of intentions when it comes to Iran. I don't think that the U.S. has the capacity to bring about actual groundbreaking change that lies with the Iranians themselves. And which is a corollary of the first, of the second, the most striking example of that is the Iran protests, which really hit the regime, you know, by surprise. And, even if the sanctions had not been imposed or reimposed then, there was still a very palpable, a deeply seated discontentment with the regime because it was very corrupt. It still is very corrupt. And the economy was being badly managed. And there were actually very profound environmental problems. So this is not something that is actually related to the U.S. Well, the U.S. has done nothing actually to foment this. Well, this is something that is purely attributable to the Islamic regime's own wrongdoings.
I see. Yeah, there's certainly a lot of blame that can be laid at the feet of the Islamic Republic, but the U.S. certainly has a lot of power, and historically speaking, at least, it's done a lot to affect the formation of governments in various countries.
Right.
Everybody knows of 1953, but then we have the more recent events, the Iraq War, and all of that. And a lot of people also argue that the U.S. didn't give the Iran nuclear deal a chance. Before Trump came to power, he talked about ripping up the deal. That sort of frightened the Europeans, and they started pulling out of Iran. And that really affected the agenda of the reformists and people who really wanted to see engagement between Iran and the U.S. in a very meaningful way, right? So I think the U.S. is partly at least responsible for what's happening and the unrest and the crisis that Iran is facing today.
Well, the recent crisis, yes, can be imputed to the United States because of the currency devaluations that Iran has been facing. But this being said, the Iran protests of 2018 in January had nothing to do with the United States. And there we saw that actual reformists had a very abysmal stance. You know, some of the prominent reformist figures actually called these people who were actually demonstrating, and these were clearly bread riots, and they called them anarchists because they were not coming from the middle class that typically supports them in Tehran. And that was actually, I think that was quite a groundbreaking moment for millions of Iranians when they could actually see through, you know, the intentions of the reformists. You know, well, this was actually a historic moment for reformists to seize and to critique the regime, saying, you know, well, this is what you've been doing, and these are the consequences on people. But the problem is, as I said, since Iran is also actually beset by deep-seated corruption, many of reformists actually figures, and their children as well, are said to be quite involved in this. So I think that's one of the reasons why actually, they were not very overt, you know, when it comes to the condemnation of the regime. And this is quite worrisome. And actually, I think that was the time when I completely lost my actually faith, which had been diminishing by then, on reform. And I said, I think they're not really fit to actually govern the country.
Yeah, that's the argument that I've heard over and over again, that the reformists actually have an interest in preserving the overall framework of the regime.
So many of them have been quite unequivocal about that as well, including Khatami, who said, you know, that he needs, his primary aim and goal is the prolongation of the regime itself. And you have some of these more well-spoken figures like Tajzadeh, he's often been compared with actually a Democrat, but I think Well, those credentials are also being overstated because, at the height of the Girls of the Revolution Street phenomena, whereby, so many Iranian women were unveiling themselves in public, his stance was not very acceptable. Well, he was actually urging the population to look for their rights gradually. So that was actually going too radically, and this was not acceptable from his point of view, which I find to be quite worrisome.
Let's switch gears to Reza Pahlavi. I'd like to hear your thoughts on him. In a recent piece in the Wall Street Journal, he called the Islamic Republic not only authoritarian, corrupt, and incompetent, but also un-Iranian and anti-Iranian.
Right.
As you know, Iran is a deeply religious country. Even though the regime is losing support, there's still a considerable percentage of the population who actually support the regime and like its ideologies. My question is, do you think Reza Pahlavi has a good understanding of the entire picture of Iran's population? And also, what do you think happens to the supporters of this regime in the future that Reza Pahlavi envisions?
Well, I think we have to make a distinction between him as a person and so many people that actually surround him. Well, first of all, I find him to be a fine gentleman who seems to have, some noble ambitions. And I don't think it's right to judge him by by the past of his parents, because he's not been, actually involved in politics. I find it to be quite mind-boggling that people would be quite fascinated with people like Mousavi or Rouhani, or expect him to bring about some very meaningful change, although it's quite well known that these people were embroiled in human rights violations, or in the case of Mousavi, although he was not directly embroiled in human rights violations, he was actually, he was a president when the notorious actually executions of political prisoners in the 1980s took place. So he still has not really actually accounted for that. Well, this being said, there still is quite a lot of people in Iran that support monarchy, so they cannot be eliminated as non-existent. I mean, that is wrong.
Do you have an idea of, the percentage of people that actually support a monarchy or Reza Pahlavi himself? I've heard varying figures. I've heard 60% and I've heard, 5%.
Under current circumstances, it's very difficult to conduct, very reliable polls in Iran because most of the polls that have been conducted, but, the polls that are actually associated with the University of Maryland are not anonymous polls. And this is something that I've been trying to raise with the people who've conducted the polls, because there are the polls whereby, some random person would call you from your home and that person would know your phone number and your name, the address information and everything. So I think actually your response would be shaped by the context in which you're living in. So the polls actually, conducted in Iran, have not really actually broached this subject. So they've not really broached the subject of to what extent he's popular. And there's actually a person by the name of Ammar Maliki, not sure whether you've heard about him. He's actually conducted a very ambitious poll. And I've seen the methodology. It's been translated into English as well. And he himself is not a monarchist. And I'm not a monarchist myself either. So he said, he conducted a poll amongst 20,000 people in Iran. And there was an online poll that was conducted on various platforms. And he's come to the conclusion that, amongst all the readers, all the leaders that had been suggested, including Yasin Sotoudeh, Mir Hossein Mousavi, Reza Pahlavi was the most popular one with a support base of 35%. But this being said, only 15% of Iranians were in favor of monarchy. So there are people who favor actual Reza Pahlavi without necessarily favoring monarchy. Now, actually, when it comes to the article that you've just talked about, I think it could have been written more professionally. Well, the fact that he considers, for instance, the clerics non-Iranians, in my opinion, is problematic because, those are from Iran, and they're coming from the interior of Iran. Well, Qom is part of Iran. Those rural places are all part of Iran. So I think actually, that wording could have been actually better made. And I also think that he seems to be associating the idea of being Iran with something supreme. So what about an Iraqi? So Amullah cannot be Iranian because he doesn't fulfill certain conditions. I mean, I agree they're actually like very violent people, but the people with the helm at the moment. But that probably was not the most politically correct term to use.
Yeah, and because so Islam is a big part of Iran, whether we like it or not. Yeah.
Right, but I'm not sure whether he said Islam should be actually eradicated from Iran. But I mean, he's...
Right.
So, but I think he's talking about the regime supporters, and we will have regime supporters, actually, even if the regime is toppled. I mean, there will still be a support base, and actually one of the scenarios that I'm quite scared of, and I hope it will not actually reproduce, but I mean, in my opinion, people have taken lesson from the past and it will not happen because we're quite an educated population, is this heavy-handedness actually against the regime supporters, which I think should not take place. So those people... I mean, as long as they've not been embroiled in egregious human rights violations, should be incorporated into the new system. Right. Because they're, I think they are from Iran as well. And I also have problems as well, although I despise Mujahideen, that is not actually, an organization that I would ever associate myself with. But those people are Iranian too. So they have been... actually following a different ideology. And I don't think they should be executed. I don't think they should be killed.
Yeah.
But they're Iranian too, as much as the clerics who are from Iran too. It's just that we should learn ways of living together.
Exactly. It'd be quite undemocratic to suppress any kind of dissent, right?
Right, absolutely.
Interesting. So you mentioned the poll conducted by Amar Maliki earlier. I've actually gotten in touch with Dr. Maliki and have asked him to come on the podcast. He may join at some point in the future. But what are your thoughts on his methodologies? I believe he conducted the poll over the Telegram app. Is that correct?
Right. Well, in fact, I mean, Telegram is not the only medium where he conducted it. It was also Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. So he's used actually all these mediums. And he had a specific criteria, though. He was trying to gauge the opinion of the people who had not voted for Raisi.
Right. I couldn't figure that one out. Why that was important?
Well, because, he's trying to gauge the opinion of the people who either voted for Rouhani or who have not voted because they're disillusioned with the regime.
Okay. So
he's trying to gauge the opinion of that stratum of the Iranian population to see actually whether they're done with reform. And the findings are quite striking and eye-catching. So many of the people that had previously voted for Rouhani have become so disillusioned with the entire reform movement that actually many of them are now considering voting for Reza Pahlavi, but without necessarily also being actually monarchists. The rising popularity of Reza Pahlavi. And so the poll was conducted a little before actual Telegram was blocked in Iran. So the timing was kind of perfect. And the participation rate was more than 20,000, which is actually quite a high sample. Now, I think you can have quite a lot of criticisms, but also a lot of actual positive words, with respect to this poll. I mean, what I find to be positive, I'm going to start with the positive, is that in contrast to the polls that have been conducted in Iran, where actual anonymity is not necessarily guaranteed, this poll is completely anonymous. Mm. So those who have participated in the polls, actually none of them would have their names in the poll. So, in light of this anonymity, people will be tempted to respond with their real option. But one of the critiques that he has received is that, it could be too much of snowballing, whereby if you happen to actually share it in a specific medium, that social media creates, these echo chambers.
Exactly.
So many of the people who voted for them will be coming from the echo chambers. That is against the regime. So, I mean, he perhaps can talk about this in much greater detail than me. But I think that the fact that the sample size was 20,000 or higher is a huge improvement. And the fact that the anonymity was guaranteed is also actually another improvement over the polls that had been conducted in Iran in the past.
Yeah, I see. So for the listeners that want to actually look at that poll, it's available on gamon.org, right? Gamon?
That's right. Right? That's right.
GAMAAN.org. All right. So I want to talk about the possibility of a referendum. Do you see a high likelihood of a referendum happening anytime in the near future? And how would it come about?
I think I would say yes and no, but it would not be in the near future. If ever it takes place, well, first of all, I find the Islamic Republic to be a very rational government, you know, because some people would say, you know, it's too preoccupied with ideology. But Islamic Republic knows how to moderate or how to become flexible at times of existential crises. You know, I think the Iran-Iraq war was one of them when Khomeini drank the poisonous chalice, or the Obama sanctions, you know, when Iran decided to come back to the negotiations table, which actually Khomeini dubbed quite actually divinely the heroic flexibility. Well, the crisis that the Islamic Republic is facing, based on so many of the reports I've been reading, is actually of a greater scale. Mm-hmm. You know, while the currency has been losing quite a lot of its value, and some people have been talking about a 60% loss since the beginning of this year, the regime is losing its most loyal, actual bastion of support, you know, which are the people in rural areas. Now we're talking about hordes of people who are living in actually urban areas who have actually immigrated from parched areas of Iran because there's a shortage of water. So there are actually a lot of grievances that have accumulated against the regime. So, I mean, I don't think that Iran has been beset by a convergence of such a multiplicity of crises in its recent history, or actually since its beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, well, people like to make the comparison with the Green Movement, saying, but, you know, there aren't as many people in the streets as the Green Movement. At the time of the Green Movement, there were millions of people who were demonstrating. Well, that is indubitably true. But the thing is, actually, the grievances that we've been hearing about at the moment, I mean, they span a larger geography than the geography of the Green Movement. And now we're talking about people of all walks of life, because some people say that the middle class has not really participated. But, you know, they did participate in recent demonstrations in Karaj, which is a middle class city, in Tehran, you know, which is actually the bastion of middle class. And I think they are also quite discontent with the way that things are going. Well, this being said, how do I foresee the possibility of conducting a referendum with the IRGC, which has dominated and monopolized various areas of the economy? I mean, actually, unless there's a surprise from the Iranian regime, unless they really bulge under intense pressure, unless they really realize that the current status quo is not tenable, the referendum will perhaps have to take place after an uprising. And even without an uprising, the current situation is not tenable because, I mean, actually, on account of the deep-seated corruption in the country, people have been witnessing a deterioration of their quality of life. You know, air quality is terrible in Iran. Well, the quality of drinkable water in Iran is terrible. Actual social services in Iran now have been talking about, I mean, actually, these are rumors, but I'm not really sure to what extent they're actually verifiable. But people have been talking about the possibility of a bankruptcy of social services in Iran.
Yeah.
Or, you know, salaries that are not being paid. And salaries not being paid, that has been going on for years. It's, you know, actually, it might have something to do with the Obama-era sanctions, but, you know, when the sanctions were lifted, well, the sanction relief did not trickle down to the most downtrodden segments of the population. I mean, that's what people have been complaining about, and I don't think this will change, even in the absence of the sanctions, because, well, the corruption is very deep-seated. So Iranians are actually confronted with the choice of dying slowly or going out and engaging in civil disobedience, as in Tunisia.
Do you have any predictions for, let's say, 2 years from now?
In fact, I don't agree with the analyses of people that say that the regime is about to collapse. It's actually a matter of time. I think the regime is not about to collapse, But if the current trends continue, which are likely to continue, in my opinion, because I don't see actually a miracle happening, you know, it could be actually on a downward spiral. And I would perhaps give 5 years or even 10 years. Unless also, as I said, a miracle happens and the regime realizes that the current situation is untenable and it decides to make significant concessions to the population.
Mm-hmm. Which would essentially be tantamount to regime change. Because if they change the identity and the core of what the Islamic Republic is, it's essentially a different system, right?
It could be a different system, or actually they could still actually call it an Islamic Republic, but really try to co-opt with the population, as they tried to co-opt the population with reformism for the past 20 years. And now that co-optation, or I guess that mechanism of co-optation, has hit rock bottom. It's not working. And they are perhaps, you know, if they're actually rational, I do think they're rational actors, you know, when it comes to their own survivals. I mean, they're not rational when it comes to the well-being of the population, but they're very rational when it comes to the longevity of the regime. They might perhaps actually come up with, something else. But, you know, I think it's about the time, and they really realized as well that they made significant concessions, whether the name or the label remains Islamic or not. And whether actually a social contract is arrived at between them and the population, whereby a significant actual number of them will be allowed to leave the country, actually in exchange for handing over the power, which in my opinion does not sound very likely. But Iranian politics is full of surprises.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that insight. So before we sign off here, I wanted to get your opinion on the divisions that are very apparent on social media amongst Iranians and various groups. We've talked about this over email, but I feel like anytime anybody has anything to say about reform or aligns himself or herself with, you know, more of a gradual change, they get labeled immediately as being regime apologists or lobbyists of the Islamic Republic or the mouthpiece of the Islamic Republic. And there are certain tactics that go the other way as well with people who are aligned with a more pro-reform agenda attacking people that want regime change. What are your general thoughts on that? How can we overcome some of these divisions and become more productive in our conversations?
In fact, well, I don't agree with reform. And I personally think that at this stage, within the context in which we are, and actually given the fact that reformists have expressed, you know, one by one, that their actually allegiance lies with the regime rather than with the idea of reform. I personally think that reform at this stage, unless we are provided with, I guess, a modified version of it, at this stage is actually regime. I mean, this being said, I do understand some people who would stick to reform because they are petrified by the scenario of, I guess, you know, Iran becoming another Syria. Right. And there are actually quite a lot of people in Tehran, you know, in big cities, in Isfahan, in Tabriz, who, in spite of hating the regime, would still side with the reformists because they don't see a viable alternative. I mean, I don't think we need a viable alternative per se, I guess, you know, actually a name. And as I said, in Tunisia, they didn't have an opposition at all. It was one of the most repressive countries in the world, according to Freedom House internet rankings. I guess internet freedom rankings, it was one of the most repressive. I mean, although they still have a very fragile democracy, I mean, they managed to patch things up and form actually quite, quite a pluralistic society. So I don't find this to be impossible in Iran. And on the other side, I guess on the other hand, I also find it to be, when we talk about regime change, it conjures up quite erroneous thoughts and positions whereby a regime change would necessarily implicate, I guess, an outside invasion of Iran. Like it's as if a regime change cannot take place with Iranians themselves while toppling their own government. So there's that misunderstanding as well when it comes to regime change. Even Reza Pahlavi himself, you know, and as I said, I'm not a monarchist, but even he himself has been averse to the idea of Iran being actually invaded by an outside force.
But the argument is that the resources have to come from somewhere, and they often come from groups that are aligned with the U.S. or Israel or whoever else that ultimately fund these opposition groups.
Right.
Is that a valid concern, or do Iranians themselves have the ability to completely be independent from these outside forces and form very viable opposition movements?
Actually, let's be rational. What resources do Iranians themselves have, really, to really foment or bring about change? I mean, I guess many of us are in the diaspora. I mean, there certainly are rich people in the diaspora as well. I mean, you know, like we all know about this TV channel called Manoto, whose funding is quite unclear. But, you know, actually, even that is being associated by some kind of a conspiracy. I mean, sure, they do have a actual pro-Reza Pahlavi line, but I mean, see, that's an example of actually resources. But I mean, and also, you know, well, the United States and Europe have been implicated in funding actual pro-democracy activists, you know, in Eastern Europe in the past. So I guess when it comes to resources, it could be the idea of actually funding things like Tavana, for instance, which has been engaged in civic education. This is the kind of resources that we need that need to be funded, or actually opening up internet in Iran, or providing actually a greater amount of actual internet connections that would enable Iranians to chat freely. And I think these are very actually uncontroversial things to do, and I'm not talking about the United States invading Iran or even imposing sanctions. I mean, I'm not really in agreement about the imposition of sanctions. They've been quite backbreaking. They've been actually hurting the wrong people. So I'm quite torn with the idea of when it comes to the idea of sanctions. I guess bringing about actually very positive change. I'm quite torn. You know, on the one hand, it runs the risk of aggravating the wrath of the population against their rulers and being even angrier with them and actually demonstrating more forcefully. But, you know, on the other hand, it runs the risk of proving very backbreaking for the middle classes and for the lower classes. So, I mean, I don't think there's actually a very facile argument that could be made, you know, in that respect. But, I mean, actually, to cut the long story short, yes, the West can help. And I think the European Union has been very passive about it. And the European Union should be very vocal about its support for pro-democracy activists in Iran. And pro-democracy activists actually is not necessarily a pro-reform activist. In fact, as you realize, there has been quite a lot of actually ruptures between pro-reformist activists and those activists who are also pro-democracy but do not envisage a path to democracy by following reform. So the European Union should recognize those activists as well, as in the case of the United States. I mean, as I said, I don't really agree with the policies of Trump. And if I were in the United States, I would have never voted for him either. And I find his stance to be actually quite worrisome. And as I said, I'm quite torn when it comes to the sanctions as well. But the idea of giving moral support to Iranian democracy activists is not a wrong move. And this is something that European Union should have actually tackled as well. And I find this to be worrisome that the European Union has not done this. And when it comes to the proponents, actually one of the questions that you've asked and I haven't responded to yet, the proponents of regime change, and they come in all shades and all colors. You know, some of them are monarchists, some of them are nothing, but they're pro-regime change, and some of them are pro-Mujahideen, but I think their actual numbers are quite negligible. I just don't like this propensity by the proponents of reform to paint them all in one color, say they're all monarchists, say they're all, in favor of invasion, and, you know, or they don't like their country, they're sellouts. And amongst regime change people, as you might have realized, Twitter has become quite vitriolic as well. Well, some of the monarchists have become quite aggressive, and this is something that I find to be actually very worrisome. You know, imposition of monarchy, and you know, accusing people of siding with the mullahs because people don't post anything about Reza Pahlavi, and as I said, I respect Reza Pahlavi because he's talking about the right things. And if he's that popular, then he should be given a chance, because I think Iranian people should be the ones that should determine their faith. And if he's truly popular and if people truly vote for him, then why not? But then, you know, I'm also torn when it comes to some of his supporters who are quite vocal about the type of Iran that they want, which doesn't sound very democratic. But I think that in a very democratic environment, we will be able to patch up our differences. And the education level of Iranians and the fact that we know that we don't want an Islamic Republic are also factors that give me hope about the future of Iran. You know, it's not all black, but there's also, you know, actually quite positive areas that we should focus on too.
I'm definitely hopeful as well. Vahid, thank you so much for your time. This was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. Very insightful.
Thank you very much for giving me this option.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Where can people follow your work?
I guess I forgot to tell about myself. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Montreal in political science. So I'm on Twitter as well. And in terms of following my work, I'm mostly on Twitter.
What's your Twitter handle?
It's my first name underscore my last name. So Vahid underscore Yucesoy.
Got it.
Yucesoy.
Excellent. All right, Vahid. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure as well. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks for listening. I hope you found that episode to be productive and interesting. If you did, please share it with your family and friends and review the podcast on iTunes or any of the other platforms. And stay tuned for a lot more great guests coming up. Thanks and take care.